Yeah, what a quick week that was. Good morning. Welcome to Friday morning's Kildare Today. Owen Beattie and Ciara Noble with you as always until 11 o'clock. And on this morning's programme, Professor Aoife McLysett, as the HSE report an 8.5% positivity rate for COVID-19 swabs in Kildare, while 18 fully vaccinated people are in hospital with the virus. We go live to Tokyo to look ahead to the Olympic Games. We also relive some of Ireland's best moments at the Games. Co-founder of the Homeless Street Cafe in Dublin, Denise Carroll, will talk to us about how her soup kitchen faces closure after food safety breaches. Most of the food there is prepared in Selbridge, so very strong connections to County Kildare. The Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission call on local authorities to do more to address the lack of traveller-specific accommodation. Some Irish holiday makers are stranded abroad, including in Spain, following a COVID-19 diagnosis. Motions and issues from the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District meeting, and we look ahead to the Leinster Minor Football Championship semi-final tomorrow between Kildare and Dublin. All of that, plus your messages to the usual sources, 0833 97 97 97. That's for the text and the WhatsApp. You can also email studio@kfmradio.com.
Kildare's KFM Morning Newspaper Review.
We also have the third instalment of our competition as well. So on Monday, Nuala Kearney was our winner in Kill, Rosemary Lamb on Wednesday in Kilteal, and today we have another OPW Family Heritage Card to give away to celebrate National Heritage Week and the National Heritage Week Awards. It's free admission to more than 45 heritage sites around Ireland for 1 year if you get yourself one of those cards. So we'll open up the competition line after 10 o'clock as always. But as we said, let's go to the newspaper review then. Ciara Noble, good morning.
Good morning, Owen Beattie.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I had an ice cream this morning.
Well, you don't have to tell me, I know. Half eight this morning.
Well, 8.39.
Whose headphones are they? Mine, are they? 8.39 this morning, eating an ice cream.
Yeah, because I just feel, I don't really eat ice cream that much. I'm a cold creature and it's so warm. I'm like, I have to take advantage of this. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, proper order. I think I'll wait until after 11 until I have mine. Half eight is a little bit too early.
We can have a second one after 11. I'm going to have a second. It's my treat after being with you for the week.
Oh, wow, right, okay. Well, I suppose, look, when the weather is so nice, you have to.
Spoil yourself.
I've been drinking iced coffees all week as well.
Yes, I had a gorgeous iced coffee yesterday. They're the best when the weather is too hot.
Yeah.
Not too hot, I shouldn't say that. It's lovely. We appreciate it. Stay longer, please. And the newspapers today, a few of them own, have noted that we're going to have a good weekend, so don't put the sunscreen away just yet.
Yeah, it's a status yellow weather warning, I think, isn't it? That's been extended now for a couple of days than further than they thought it would be initially. 24 to 28 degrees today, slightly cooler along the coast, but mainly the heat is going to be in the Midland counties, as I said, including Kildare. Ciara, we'll start off with you then in the Independent. Now, we heard this in our news bulletin as well. Permanent TSB in a potential deal for €7.6 billion Ulster Bank loans in a move that would make UK major shareholder. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so the bank has agreed this is potentially to acquire the €7.6 billion, as you said, of Ulster Bank's assets in a deal that would make the British state-controlled bank NatWest a major shareholder in the Irish lender. PTSB, Ulster Bank and NatWest, they've signed a memorandum of understanding to work towards permanent.
That's the microphone again there, Ciara.
Can you hear me?
You might just need to move it around. I don't know what the story is at all. Whenever you go into the studio too, something ends up broken.
Yes, I know. It's me, obviously. but yeah, the three banks I've noted there, they're signing a memorandum of understanding to work towards the acquisition of Ulster Bank's non-tracker mortgage books, its SME lending portfolio and the Lombard asset finance business. It would also involve the transfer of 25 Ulster Bank branches into the permanent TSB network. So that's along with 500 Ulster Bank employees. The current accounts, they're not a part of the plans transaction. And the transaction would be financed partly by NatWest, which is Ulster Bank's owner, taking a 20% equity stake in permanent TSB.
If we take a look at the Examiner then, and another heartbreaking story, boy aged 15 becomes the fifth victim of lake drowning incidents this week. It's a swimming accident, we're told, earlier this week. The boy got into difficulty on Tuesday while swimming in Loch Sheelan, which borders Cavan, Westmeath and Meath. He was taken from the water shortly before 3 o'clock on Tuesday, was taken to the Temple Street Hospital, where he died on Thursday evening. His death, as I said, brings to five the number of people who have drowned in separate incidents in lakes this week. On Wednesday, a young mother in her late 20s drowned in a County Cavan lake while trying to rescue a child. Gardaí were called to the scene at Loch Gowna shortly before 9:30 p.m. on Wednesday evening. It's believed she may have been trying to help a child return to the shore. She's been named locally as Natasha Corr, who is from Gowna. Miss Corr's body was recovered near the shoreline by Cavan Fire Services and Civil Defence shortly afterwards. Meanwhile, the Examiner goes on to tell us that a man in his 70s died while snorkelling at Spencer Harbour in Drumcarran in County Leitrim. The alarm was raised at around 9 p.m. on Wednesday when the man failed to return to the surface. His body was recovered from the water a short time later, and he was named locally as Michael Hoey. And the Examiner has more details as well about those tragedies that have happened during the week. And Ciara, again, just to reiterate, exercise the utmost caution when you're out on the water, and you know, just follow all the safety guidelines. And again, watersafety.ie has some very useful tips as well. Back in the Independent, Ciara, staff shortages. Where is the staff shortages this time?
Well, it's a particular restaurant in Dublin that is speaking to Barbara Power of the Independent. They're quoted here as saying John O'Sullivan, the owner of Rowley's Restaurant in Bald Bridge, he says there have been staffing problems in the industry over the years, but this is the worst I've ever seen. He has more than 60 years experience, so it is a bit of a worry to hear that from somebody who's, I guess, such a senior figure in the restaurant industry. He says he was in business in the 1980s when, you know, economically things were very, very poor and you couldn't get staff at all. It was impossible, but this is the worst. They have Rowley's Restaurant. They've been able to get outside onto the footpaths area in Balls Bridge, but they've noted that only their first floor restaurant will now open for indoor dining. As we know, that will take place from the 26th of July. They did refurbish it during the lockdown, so they're anxious to get it open, but it'll only be open 3 days a week, which is away from the usual 7 days. And then a lot of people may have heard of Panty Bliss, who is also known as Rory O'Neill. His bar, Panty Bar, it's on Penny Lane in Dublin. They announced yesterday that they'll not be reopening indoor dining services until all the staff are fully vaccinated. He's quoted as saying, "I'm fully vaccinated and reasonably fit and healthy, so I'm pretty relaxed about it personally, but I don't want to make that decision for the young staff that we have working for us. So for us, it was a relatively easy decision to say we'll wait a few more weeks until everyone is vaccinated."
Back in the Irish Examiner then, and Noel Baker has an article here. Tusla has said 2020 was a very challenging year with almost 70,000 referrals made, and its chief executive saying efforts are continuing to move its services from crisis to normal in the context of the COVID-19 response. Tusla launches its latest annual report today, showing there were almost 1,000 health and safety issues involving its staff last year, 883 of which related to violence, harassment or aggression. Tusla's National Incident Management System also saw the highest ever annual number of incidents recorded at 1,830, with those incidents notified to the State Claims Agency. And obviously there's much more detail on that because it is their annual report, and we'll reflect on it later on as well. Funeral of Progressive Democrats founder Des O'Malley, Ciara, this morning, covered across a majority of the newspapers, but you're going to take the Journal.
Yeah, and it's going to be a private family funeral, obviously. There's only 50 mourners that can attend funerals at the moment. It's going to take place at the Church of the Sacred Heart in Donnybrook, and the Mass is available online to watch from 12 o'clock. That's when the Mass will take place. But obviously, we know he died on Wednesday, Des O'Malley, at the age of 82. He was a Limerick man, you know, a former Fianna Fáil minister, we heard it noted in the news there. And yeah, very sad day for his whole family. His wife, Patricia, he was married to her for 52 years, until her death in 2017, and they had 6 children.
Yeah, and we covered it on the programme on Wednesday with political correspondent with the Irish Independent, John Downing, and indeed we talked about the controversy, if you want to call it that, that Des O'Malley had with Charles Haughey back in the 80s and the 70s as well.
Do you know what, Owen? For my thesis, I basically did something on the 2011 election, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember watching documentaries at the time about Charlie Haughey and Des O'Malley, and it was fascinating. You don't get that kind of drama in today's Irish politics.
No.
And I think anybody who doesn't know what the story is there, like younger people like us, we wouldn't really know about, you know, the politics of the 70s, 80s. Do check some of those documentaries out, because it is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funeral, as Ciara mentioned, of Des O'Malley taking place today. And it's been great to see all the tributes that have been pouring in throughout the course of the week, and may he rest in peace. Back in the Irish, to take a look at the Irish Times, concerns within the government that its 10-year housing plan was being rushed and would be vulnerable to opposition attack led to the surprise decision on Thursday to postpone its publication for several weeks. Some of you may have heard of this yesterday. The Housing for All publication, which will determine the state's housing policy and plans until 2030, was due to be published next Tuesday, but is now not likely to be launched until late August or early September. The last-minute decision announced by Minister for Housing Dara O'Brien was immediately seized on by the opposition as a sign of tensions between the three coalition parties on the plan, which will replace Rebuilding Ireland. The government, of course, has denied that there's any divisions on funding or indeed on any other aspects of the plan, but the late withdrawal is being seen as a setback. Interesting, that. Ciara, back in the Independent then, Irish geneticists to make a breakthrough discovery, or have they already, on the cause of fatal childhood cancer.
Yeah, so we're actually going to have Dr. Adrian Bracken on Kildare Focus later. He's from Trinity, and they're the scientists who found a specific genetic mutation called H3K27M, which causes the cancer known as diffuse midline glioma, DMG. In these studies, they've been able to successfully reverse its effect to slow the cancer cell growth with a targeted drug. It's been published in the International Journal of Nature Genetics, supported by Worldwide Cancer Research in the Brain Tumor Charity. So there are two massive, obviously, bodies that are supporting this. So Adrian will speak to us later. And obviously, good news there, Owen, because health-wise, we've heard so much bad news over the past 18 months that it's nice to hear something like that.
Yeah, certainly is. And on the sporting front as well, we're going to be talking about the Olympics in the second hour of the programme. We're going to be going live to Tokyo to speak to sports journalist with the Irish Examiner, Brendan O'Brien. He's originally from Leash, but actually living in Nace now since 2017. And he's over in Tokyo, so we'll join him. But obviously the papers are covering it this morning, and a headline in the Irish Times: pride in Dublin's inner city as most loveliest Kelly Harrington carries the flag for Ireland. After a hard COVID for Dublin's north inner city, Irish flags are flying, bunting is fluttering, and the sun is out as Portland Row gets ready to cheer on a local Olympic hero. Lifelong resident Kelly Harrington, 31, may not have lifted a glove for her first bout yet, but already the mood is jubilant. Almost every house has some show of support in the front window with posters proclaiming good luck or all more Kelly Harrington, which is obviously good luck in Irish. And the opening ceremony taking place at 12 o'clock today. And Ciara, we were doing quite a lot of research on this yesterday throughout the course of the day, and just delving into the archives, I suppose, of the Olympics. And it is a fascinating competition. Now, I know, you know, this year's Olympics over in Tokyo has been surrounded by controversy, particularly in the city itself, but it's just a fantastic occasion.
Tell me this, what is your best memory or your most favourite memory of the Olympics?
Katie Taylor's gold medal, without a shadow of a doubt. Without a shadow of a doubt.
I remember the Olympics of 2000 in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was seven at the time, and I was really into athletics, and Sonia O'Sullivan was there. She was like my hero at the time. I absolutely loved her. And I remember seeing that at the time. I remember hearing about, wasn't Michelle Smith? That was 96. I was very young, but I think I was three.
Mm.
But I remember hearing people speaking about, I think she did, was it
swimming?
She positive for something, or there was some sort of situation about about that at the time, which was upsetting. But yeah, I remember as a kid being much more fascinated by it than recent years, which is sad. But in 2012, I think all our, aside from obviously Katie Taylor, who, you know, hands down, one of the most amazing Olympians to come out of Ireland, but it was nice to have it so close to home. I know, like, London being across the water, we did have more of a connection, even time-wise, because obviously we're in bed for some of these, and the same when it happens in other Eastern countries and down in Australia and Beijing in 2008. You're not awake and you're not up to date with everything.
Mm. And I know as well that there is actually some Kildare connections to the Olympics as well over the course of the next coming weeks. And Shamie Moore, the mayor of Naas, got in touch with us as well to wish the Naas area and the Kildare competitors in Tokyo the very best of luck. So Billy Dardis of Naas, he's involved with the rugby team. Keane O'Connor, of course, he was a resident in Johnstown for quite a while. He's involved in equestrian, as is Heike Holstein from Carberry in the equestrian. And Susan O'Grady, the CEO of K-Leisure, again, has been selected on the anti-doping Olympic staff. So a lot of Kildare connections to the games this year. And I was reading as well, Ciara, Larry Stanley from Prosperous as well. The Irish Examiner did an article yesterday, I think it was, looking at each county's winners of medals at the Olympics for Ireland.
Yes.
And Larry Stanley, he played GAA for Kildare, I think, but also in athletics. He won a medal originally from Prosperous. So there are some strong connections, which is good.
If you could play a sport in the Olympics, what sport would it be?
I don't know. See, what I love about the Olympics, right, is the diversity in the sports. So you have the likes of shooting and archery and judo and sailing, for example. These kind of sports that never get brought to the forefront in the normal scheme of things, if you know what I mean. Because obviously there's soccer as well, there's athletics, there's rugby, and they're all what we're accustomed to. But I just love watching some of the stranger sports. So I probably would get involved in one of them just for the crack. Okay. Yourself?
I think I'd do something like tennis. I absolutely love tennis. Or maybe athletics. I mean, Usain Bolt, that's another absolute favourite memory. He's amazing. Yeah, things like that. I mean, you are right. It is cool seeing things that you wouldn't normally watch, like diving. I'd never watch diving on TV usually. But when it comes to the Olympics, you're like, oh, great, they got a score of whatever. Or the gymnasts. Aren't they incredible? Yeah. Simone Biles of the US, if anybody out there hasn't heard of her, look her up. She's amazing. She's about 4'9", and she is incredible at what she does. I watched an interview with the other day, and she does 38 hours of just pure training a week. That's not, you know, taking into account, you know, lifting the weights and doing all the extra stuff in the gym. Just pure training for the Olympics. And that's what, there's a story here in the journal this morning, Owen, saying that people are feeling sorry for the athletes because the Olympics opening ceremony will take place in front of an empty stadium. But who I feel even more sorry for is those athletes who've literally spent 5 years now, because obviously the Olympics didn't happen last year, you know, training for this, and, you know, they'll test positive because, you know, on the flight over, or, you know, they come in contact with somebody in the Olympic Village, and unfortunately they won't be able to then take part in the games. Like, that must be soul destroying. So yeah, just all the best of luck to all the Irish athletes, and hopefully they can stay safe and healthy and no COVID cases.
Yeah, and as I said, about 10:25 we'll be talking to Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner live over in Tokyo, and we'll relive some of the greatest Irish moments and also some of the game-changing moments as well from the Olympics down through the course of the years. Now, Ciara, just one final story then from you this morning. It's in the journal. Ex-Garda fighting Europe's €14 billion drugs trade. What's this about?
Yeah, so Irish criminals, they're now among the biggest players in the estimated, as you said, €14 billion annual business of transatlantic drug smuggling into Europe. This is a European law enforcement expert, Michael O'Sullivan, who's been interviewed by the journal. It's a very in-depth article, very interesting. Anybody wants to check it out, it's online this morning. He's the former head of the precursor to the Garda Drugs and Organised Crime Bureau, and he's now leading the Maritime Analysis and Operations Centre Narcotics in Portugal. And this is International Anti-Drug Trafficking Agency. It was founded by a group of EU member states, including Ireland, in the 2000s. 2000s, and he's just noting how powerful the Irish criminals are. They're senior players in the upper echelons of the multi-billion euro drug trafficking European industry, what O'Sullivan says here. So it's like love-hate come to life.
Yeah, absolutely. Just reading a little bit about Larry Stanley as well, because we got a text in on the WhatsApp to say Larry Stanley was regarded as one of the greatest footballers ever to play for Kildare. He played with Cara. He had a hugely successful career with Cara, winning two county club championships. He also played with the Garda Club in Dublin, but he was a very successful high jumper and represented Ireland at the 1924 Summer Olympics. In retirement from sport, Stanley came to be recognised as one of the greats of Gaelic football. In 1980, he was the inaugural recipient of the All-Time All-Star Award, and he was posthumously included on a special selection of the greatest Garda football team ever as well. He was born in 1896 in Prosperous, and he died in 1987 at the age of 91, and his occupation was obviously a guard as well. He played centre forward in GAA. He won two county club titles, like I said, with Cara, and also represented Ireland at the Summer Olympics. So a great achievement for him as well, and great to have that Kildare connection. Now, just before we take a break, I want to let you know that a book of condolences has been opened in Newbridge for Mr. Joe Wood, who passed away. It's been opened at the Whitewater Shopping Centre. This was opened up by the Mayor of Newbridge, Rob Power. Councillor Power was joined by Mr. Wood's British Legion colleagues, Charlie Ward and Donal Flynn, and by Whitewater Operations Manager, Peter Bartizel. Joe Wood died on Sunday at the age of 100. He was a decorated veteran of the Royal Air Force, having served in World War II, including during the liberation of Denmark. He'd be well known in the community of Newbridge as well. And Ciara, obviously you've been a native of Newbridge, you would have seen him around the place.
Yeah.
Indeed, I remember seeing him around the place. We had him on air as well, and he used to carry his medals around, and he was a great character.
He had them on his lapel of his jacket, and I have to say, he was so fast in his wheelchair as well. You'd see him speeding by you when you're in Whitewater, but he was a face everybody around Newbridge knew, and it's very sad. He lived to 100, and as you know, obviously Clem spoke to him a few months ago, and he's quite colourful with his comedy as well. So it's very sad news, but what a life.
Yeah, his funeral will take place this morning at 11 a.m. The funeral cortege is expected to pause outside the Whitewater for a moment's silence before continuing its journey to St. Patrick's Church on Moorfield Road. And may he rest in peace, and condolences to the family. After the break, we will be talking to Professor Aoife McLysett. All right, you're welcome back to the programme. As we mentioned in our newspaper review, there's an 8.5% positivity rate for COVID-19 swabs taken here in County Kildare, and also the HSE are reporting that 18 fully vaccinated people are in hospital with the virus. To discuss this and more, Professor Aoife McLysett is a professor in the Molecular Evolution Laboratory of the Smurfit Institute of Genetics at Trinity College in Dublin. Professor McLysett, good morning to you. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Before we discuss what I mentioned there at the outset, what is your current view or your current stance on the current situation here in the country in relation to COVID-19?
I think it's very worrying. We're seeing the cases going up very rapidly. And by the end of the month or the beginning of August, we could be at 3,000 daily cases, and it'll keep going up. It's doubling in just about a week or 10 days, something like that. And so that'll get up to very high numbers by back to school time, which would put us in a position where we're trying to figure out, is it safe to go back to school, which is not a position we should be in. It shouldn't be like this. We should have not let this happen. And I think this opening up that we've done before we had finished rolling out the vaccine to everybody, like we passed the milestone of 50% of the population being vaccinated, which is a great milestone, but we have started opening up a while ago, and we've had the numbers of cases increasing. If we had allowed the vaccination program to run much further before any opening up, then there wouldn't have been a breeding ground for the virus to spread so much like there is now. So we still have such a huge number of unvaccinated people or only partially vaccinated that there's just too much room for the virus to spread.
I'm sure, though, you'll appreciate, Professor McLeish, the position of, in particular, the publicans, the hoteliers, the restaurateurs, etc., who have really been impacted quite strongly by the pandemic over the last year and a half. They've been lobbying the government, the health officials, to allow the reopening of that sector. But could they have really sustained another couple of months? How much longer would you have kept locked down for?
Well, okay, so if it was up to me, it would have been different in that we would have got case numbers down in other ways and resourced public health doctors better so that we weren't relying on lockdowns. And it could have been in a context of low case numbers. We wouldn't have had to wait for vaccination. And this is something that we've been arguing for a while, that the wait for vaccination was quite a long wait and we should do other things, get the case numbers down earlier, so we could have a safe reopening. But we reopened before the vaccination program was completed and in the context of quite high case numbers when we started, you know, reopening the outdoor hospitality and all of the other things, and the mood change that went along with that, because it was giving the message that things were fine and things were safe. And so we saw this big increase. So I do sympathize greatly with the people whose work has been disrupted and whose ability to trade has been disrupted over the last year, but they haven't been helped by premature actions and premature openings. And we saw that in December when they opened for 3 weeks. And I think for a lot of premises, a lot of businesses, they said it was a very expensive reopening because they had to buy in stock and do a lot of things, but then only managed to have 3 weeks of operation. So I do sympathize and I really understand that they are keen to open up again. But by doing things in the wrong time, it doesn't necessarily last. And we don't know how long this is going to last now. We don't know how long it's going to, how high will the numbers go before the government says once again that it's intolerable and we need to start closing down again. It depends a bit on their appetite for this, but I think also on what's going to happen with the hospitals and if we get a lot of occupancy of hospitals, which will unavoidably displace other types of care. It will mean that other kinds of healthcare we'll have to go on to longer and longer waiting lists, which we already didn't have a good waiting list situation before this, and now it's worse. And so I do sympathise, but I don't think the solution is a hasty reopening under the wrong circumstances.
Obviously, we don't have a crystal ball, and a lot of us would much prefer if we did to know what will happen further down the line. But do you envisage another lockdown coming? Because we know there is obviously the Delta variant is wreaking havoc. But the Taoiseach is saying as well that there's a wave coming further down the line. What do you think the response to that should be?
Well, I think we should be we should be throwing all the money we have at our public health doctors. And it's crazy that in a public health crisis, we haven't done this already, because they can do a huge amount of outbreak management and outbreak containment that doesn't interfere with your daily life in the same way that lockdown does. Lockdown is an emergency crisis response when things have gone so badly and so beyond that it's the only possible reaction, because of course the public health doctors can't deal with thousands and thousands of cases a day. That's just not feasible. So when you have the numbers more manageable, if you resource them properly, then we can have much more targeted, localized, focused interventions. But if it goes crazy again, if the numbers go way up again, yeah, we might be looking into another lockdown. And that is so depressing. That's not what I want. It's not what anybody wants. But at some point, it might become necessary. And it'll become necessary for the failure to do the other things that could have managed the case numbers.
In terms of vaccination, then, what do you make of the vaccination rollout here in the country? And also the news that I mentioned there at the start of the interview, that the HSE are saying that 18 fully vaccinated people in hospital with COVID-19 has been confirmed. Would that worry you, that even though people are fully vaccinated, they're still getting the virus?
Well, I think so. Two parts to your question. So first of all, I think that the vaccination rollout has been really great in this country, and you couldn't ask for better. We have essentially been delivering the vaccine to people within the same week as it arrives in the country. It's been really efficient. We've had extraordinary uptake. People want the vaccines. People are registering and presenting for their vaccines. So that's all really good. With regard to some vaccinated people still getting infected, this is actually something that you can expect, because as we know, the efficacy and the of these vaccines is not 100%. So there's always going to be a certain number of people for whom it doesn't quite take. And then in a context where you have really, really rapidly increasing case numbers and lots of spread, those small number of people who it hasn't quite worked in will be found, let's say, by the virus. And then there's another aspect to this as well, which is the people that we rightly prioritized for vaccination were the most vulnerable in our population. And the reasons that they might be vulnerable, one could be that some of those individuals might be immunocompromised or immunosuppressed, for example, if they have received an organ transplant in the past. And so those people are also have, they take the vaccine and we hope it works in them, but it's a slightly lower efficacy in those individuals as well. And people who are older, their immune system doesn't always work as efficiently as a younger person. So the people who will have received the vaccine first, they'll be less vulnerable than they were before, but there's still potentially some vulnerabilities there. So it's not a shock that some people still get sick. And I think that's important that people realize that just being vaccinated doesn't mean you're bulletproof. And in the context of a lot of spread in the population, you still need to be somewhat cautious. And I think the easiest thing you can do for yourself, though, is wear a good quality mask. You can get not just what they call face covering, which can be even t-shirt material or something, but there are good quality masks that really block a lot of particles. And you can buy reusable, washable ones of these or the disposable ones, but that'll make a big difference. But also the usual stuff that everybody knows, you know, don't get up close to people, keep a bit of distance, try to be in a well-ventilated place. You know, outside is the best, but indoor spaces can also be properly ventilated if necessary. But this is not a surprise, but it might be a surprise to a lot of people in that they might have thought that the vaccine just meant that nothing could happen.
And finally then, Professor McLysett, obviously we've seen the rollout of the digital COVID cert in recent times, and that has come with its controversy as well. But there's also people now leaving the country, going into mainland Europe, different parts of the world, and there's people coming in from other countries as well. And we're going to be talking about this later on in the programme with Owen Corrie. But just a brief view on that with regard to international travel.
Well, I probably sound like a terrible killjoy, but I just don't think it's the right time. The pandemic is raging worldwide, and the reason we are in a worse situation now than expected is because of the Delta variant that came in through travel. And if our existing checks, like the PCR test and those things, were sufficient, we wouldn't be talking about the Delta variant. So adding more travel into the mix is not good news. It's what has ruined things for us multiple times over. The Irish people have really done everything possible. We have multiple times now had lockdowns which brought the case numbers right down. And had it not been for international travel, we'd be living in a much more comfortable way now, and we wouldn't be talking about rising case numbers, and we wouldn't be having all of these problems. So unfortunately, the failure to properly manage international travel has been the thing that has held us back all this time. So, no, not in favour, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, on that note, Professor Aoife McLysett, Professor in the Molecular Evolution Laboratory of the Smurfit Institute of Genetics at Trinity College Dublin, thanks for joining us on the programme this morning, Aoife.
Now we are going to head to the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, and it's good morning to Fine Gael Councillor Peggy O'Dwyer.
Morning, Ciara.
Peggy, you do want to speak to the listeners this morning just in terms of the vaccination programme.
Yes, just following on from Professor McLysett's interview there with Owen, I just want to really, really enforce to encourage people to come forward for their vaccinations. The recent figures show that 87% of the people that are positive under 40 So it's really important that people come forward, and particularly for their second dose, the booster dose. The booster dose is equally important as the first one, and it's 2 weeks after the booster dose that you get the best protection. So I understand that people may not, but we've had situations in Punchestown that we've had substantial numbers of people that haven't turned up for vaccinations. So everybody's working really hard, from GPs to pharmacies to the vaccination centres, and collaboratively it's about trying to get our economy back, it's about trying to get education, our healthcare, and unless we get our vaccination programme really, really completed quickly, it is the only way forward, as well as all the other restrictions that we all know and well know about at this stage. So I'm just making this call for people. If you get an invitation for a vaccination, please, please turn up.
Yeah, and you yourself, Peggy, are vaccinating at the point.
Yes, yes, and for me, it's been a privilege. My life was devoted to people who were sick, but this is about preventing illness, and I just want to make a plea to people, please turn up for your vaccination.
Yes. A nurse as your former profession, yeah. Some people may word it as now, Peggy. But turning to your profession as a councillor, obviously the meeting of Newbridge, or Kildare Newbridge, took place on Wednesday. And one of the motions you put forward was a time frame for the commencement of the upgrade of St. Connaught Cemetery car park as we move out of restrictions.
Yes, and just before I start, here I want to congratulate Rob Power and Chris Pender as our new Cathaoirleach and last Cathaoirleach. They're going to make a great team for the Kildare MD. Yes, in relation to the cemetery, we know cemeteries are blessed burial grounds, and no more than COVID, they were places that were visited much more probably than before that. So Newbridge St. Connaught Cemetery has been listed, the car park in particular, for upgrade for some time, got delayed during COVID. But as well as that, there were other issues around the cemetery as well, and I had a site visit there in April with the Director of Services, Joe Boland, and Ken Kavanagh, and we identified other areas within the cemetery as well, like the benches, the footpaths, there's potholes. So as well as the car park, which is due to start soon, there are other issues which they have committed to put on the list, and hopefully we'll see everything improving there from relation to the cemetery itself and the upgrade of the car park.
Now, Peggy, you asked the council to confirm if there's a green waste collection service offered to the Residents Association within the municipal district. Just explain that one there, Peggy.
Well, a green waste, you probably notice around springtime or early summertime that you see multiple residents association groups out trimming hedges, you know, along by walls and boundary walls. But one resident association particularly asked me about how would they get rid of the green waste, and they were under the assumption that Kildare County Council provided the service. They don't. So what they have said, that Ciliate Hill will accept green waste at a reduced cost. But my argument was, not all residents association have the transport to actually, you know, remove the waste to Ciliate Hill. So they have also offered the services of the environmental awareness officer to maybe help residents associations set up a composting area within estates, which actually seems a very good idea, because it is about biodiversity and it is about encouraging. And when you create those compost ways, who knows what you may be able to get off it going forward from the point of view of looking after flower beds and that. So it's probably not what the Resident Association wanted to hear, but there isn't any other way around it, unfortunately. They're not going to collect green waste.
Okay, Peggy, speed reduction. You're speaking about the roundabout. I believe the mini roundabout. It's at Rosebery.
The mini roundabout here, you know it well.
I go around it.
It's a single lane roundabout which has three roads. Usually a roundabout will have four. And you know it's there in Bardstown, situated near the school, the church, residence, no pedestrian crossing, and many people actually come from Nice and other areas to get into Newbridge using this route. So we know the most effective way to reduce danger is to reduce speed, but this roundabout has a particular restricted sight line on it, particularly when you're coming from the Barrettstown side. Traffic from the Sexes Road can have full vision from town, so they see there's nothing on the right lane, but sometimes they just drive right through it and they probably don't know that there actually is a left lane. Mm-hmm. So Brendan Cuddy has agreed to come out and have a look to see if there's anything else that we could do to make it a safer roundabout. There isn't much scope to expand it because it's quite a restricted junction.
Okay.
So hopefully we can make that a safer roundabout.
Okay, Peggy, finally, you want to wish the best of luck to the sash?
Oh, I do. Sarsfield hurlers are out tomorrow evening, county final against Maynooth, the junior hurling team. Some of the players, including my son, have been on the team over 20 years. The husband is a selector, so it's a great game for them. And it's great to see hurling really coming forward in Kildare. Football is always there, but it's great to see the hurling actually coming up as well. So I want to wish them the very, very best of luck.
Well, Peggy O'Dwyer, councillor for Fine Gael of the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, thank you, and over to you all.
Thank you. Two pop-up soup kitchens in Dublin which serve food and drinks to people who are homeless may have to close due to compliance issues with food safety standards following inspections from the Health Service Executive. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by co-founder of the Homeless Street Cafe, Denise Carroll. Denise, good morning. Welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having us.
Denise, tell us what's going on here, because the headline, as it suggests, would mean that the HSE have essentially found that your homeless service is not compliant with food safety regulations.
Yeah, it's all come as a bit of a shock for us. We've been operating for 5 years and we've never had any interaction like this before. I suppose when we talk about it, our homeless service now, it sounds all very professional and maybe large and big, but we really are just a group of normal working people who are trying to kind of put together the little bit of kindness that we can in our community and help to try and feed the homeless. But we did get inspected by the HSE, the Environmental Health Department, and they have put to us that there's a number of regulations that we are meeting.
Is this the first time that you've been inspected then in the 5 years?
Absolutely. First interaction we've ever had. So it was quite shocking for us.
And what were the findings then when this inspection took place? What exactly are you not compliant with, so to speak?
So when the inspectors arrived, we had a chat and they just asked us about how the food was produced, and they asked us about allergens and storage and how we delivered the food then once we actually got into the city centre. So some of the things that they've identified is that the kitchen, so for example, if one person is making us some sandwiches this week, that their kitchen hasn't been registered as a HSE site, their home hasn't been then inspected by the HSE, and that they weren't HACCP trained. Other things were that we didn't have a sink in town for hand washing. So when we say the Homeless Street Cafe, it really is a bit ironic. It's not a cafe. It's some tables on the side of the street where we're trying to deliver the food that has been donated to us for the homeless. So we don't have a sink or hand washing. We have hand sanitization stations and gloves and masks and aprons and all of that, but that wasn't something that we had considered.
So essentially what the HSE are saying, if I'm inferring from this correctly, is that everybody who's preparing this food needs to be HACCP trained.
Yeah, HACCP trained, and that's one point which, you know, we could do our very best to meet, but in actual fact, though, every kitchen, and we rely on our community, every kitchen that bakes a bun, that makes sandwich, does anything, has to be a registered HSE site. They have to be regularly inspected. And you can imagine if someone comes forward to say, well, do you know what, I'll make you a nice cake this week to bring in to the homeless. They're not really wanting to bring onto themselves that level of work and intrusion, I suppose, in their life, you know. All we're trying to do is meet this desperate need that we're seeing each week, and we're having 200 to 300 people standing in a queue waiting for us when we arrive. We're just trying to share the food that we all already have with somebody else. We never wanted to be a massive organisation or anything like that, and this really has been kind of a real blow for us.
I can't get my head around this, Denise, to be perfectly honest with you.
Welcome to the club.
Because I'd imagine you're relying heavily on the public, because the food, the majority, if not all of the food, would be donated from the public, and people would see it as a good turn. Like, you know, I've often given food to charities to help out, because they'd be crying out for donations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a kind of, you know, the ethos of good community spirit, people coming together to support something and donate. Like, we don't want to be a business and we don't want to be a charity fundraiser and having CEOs. We really just wanted to rely on what people could give us in donations of food. And, you know, if this comes, if this is allowed to pass, that day is gone. I have to say to you, I have a couple of pensioners who would make me sandwiches. They take turns every so often. So now I have to tell them, you're not fit to feed the hungry, because you need to jump through this hoop and that hoop and register your home with the HSE. That's too much. You know, we really just want to feed some hungry people. We have had no complaints. This came on photos. No complaints, no interactions whatsoever. So it's like a shock and blow for us, and could actually be the end of soup kitchens throughout Dublin, not just us.
So you're based obviously in Dublin city centre itself, but I understand that you have a strong connection to Kildare, because I read somewhere that a lot of the food as well is prepared around the Selbridge area, and a lot of people from Kildare would donate food to yourselves.
Yeah, so I'm living in Selbridge, as is my mum, who helped me to start this, and a number of cooks, bakers, sandwich makers, the local schools donate their Halloween treats to us. We have so many entities in the community here that are helping us in Selbridge, you know, and beyond, you know, the new Strafford and the surrounding areas. And it's been beautiful to see, I have to say, without being dramatic. I open my door on a Tuesday here in Selbridge and people are arriving and they've made a special cake for somebody. I might have mentioned something that one of the homeless have said to me, like, I remember he said he liked picking berries when he was young, you know, and I've made this lovely berry pie for them. And the thought and the care that's gone into it, I just think would be tragic to tell all of these people, you're no longer worthy to help the homeless.
So what happens now, Denise, or what is the current situation that you find yourselves in? Have you temporarily stopped serving on the streets of Dublin?
No, we were in on Tuesday, just gone there, and they didn't ask us to stop trading straight away, or trading isn't the right word, stop operating. But they did tell us that they will be back to us on this Tuesday coming now to reinspect, to see that we meet all the criteria they set out for us. And we won't be able to meet it. So,
but that's what I was going to ask. Is it possible to meet the criteria that the HSE have set out?
So if I was to go to our community, I'm probably looking like at maybe 40 plus homes that I would have to register as HSE sites with their permission. I then have to get, I don't know, 40 to 60 people have to train. I have to come up with a way of having hand washing at our table for the people that serve for us at the table. I mean, I just can't meet those criteria right now. The other thing is, if I sign up as a food business, which is what they are denoting I am in the letters from the environmental health, I am then signing up to all those regulations. And I just think that's the point of no return, because then I am saying, yes, if anyone wants to feed a hungry person. So if you're having your lunch and there's a homeless person there and you want to give them half of your lunch, you can't. You know, this is where the world goes a bit mad. And I think to sign up and agree to that is terrible. I don't ever want to do that. But I'm going to have to see what happens next on Tuesday.
But the homeless in this country are suffering, like, inexplicable poverty. We have a homeless crisis, you know. They can't get into homes, they struggle to get into emergency accommodation. And now if we take away a basic human right, which is feeding them, and I understand, you know, the HSE's perspective and what they're trying to implement, and to play devil's advocate to say that they understand their point of view. But, I mean, I think maybe it's a step too far.
Absolutely. You know, I'm dealing with these people 5 years now, and they are so grateful for our service. But this is almost like you said, if we take this away, as well as everything else that they're dealing with, you know, I think we're punishing the homeless. And when did anybody ever ask their consent on what they want? Because the queue I have there every week tells me there is a need, and that they're all consenting to eat everything that we're producing. You know, we produce it in our homes. And I think it's a really dangerous place to go. I've heard in some of the statements that have been released from the HSE that, you know, we need to have certain standards and we can't segregate the poor. Absolutely. You know, I agree. I want to treat these people absolutely as best as we can with the highest standards of hygiene. But they have said, well, these are immunocompromised people. I'm a nurse myself. I understand this. They're immunocompromised because of their social circumstances. We're talking about people sleeping in tents with rats and whatnot running around on the canal, sleeping in damp doorways, having a lack of access to hand washing, toileting and nutrition. You know, I think those things should be addressed in terms of their immunocompromisation, more so than the food that someone cooks in their own home to try and give them a little bit of nutrition.
Well, we'll leave it there. We'll definitely keep an eye on this situation as it develops. I've been aware of the work that the Homeless Street Cafe has done for a number of years. I've seen your pages on Facebook and Twitter and everything, and I think you offer a great service. But it remains to be seen what happens from it. But we will keep in touch with you, and indeed you keep in touch with us if you hear anything back as well. That's Denise Carroll, co-founder of the Homeless Street Cafe. Many thanks for that, Denise, and good morning.
Thank you.